Category E6,
Sports Broadcaster of the Year,
Joe Malloy.
It seems, you know, maybe the defining moment of your career comes against Bulgaria. I would like to hear your memory of it, if that is okay.
But
you lost the ball and they scored, and
it's not a memory, it's just the fact that I was the main scorer, I was I was voted Players' Player of the Year this season, so yes, it was good, so they put me on the bench, and 20 minutes towards the end, I went on, played, got this free kick on the side, crossed the ball for Cantona, and the cross was too long. They get the ball back and they run, then four passes, they went 90 meters on the other side, bang, top corner, and we've been eliminated.
What's your reaction when that goal goes in? Obviously, disappointment.
We're not going to talk about that all day, because it's a very, very sad souvenir for me. So if we can just move...
Really? That's a very difficult thing to talk about.
It's not a difficult thing. I try to avoid... Not to avoid this. I mean, I don't want to be... It's just part of my career.
No,
I don't want to make a big deal of that.
No, sure. I suppose my point was we had maybe a limited amount of time, and to cover all your career would be very difficult.
Yeah,
I would love to hear your thoughts on this.
My career is a mix of so many different things.
Sure.
This is one-off because it has an impact on my future as a player for my country. That's why I didn't play the World Cup in France in 1998.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I mean, what can I say? It's done. Nothing I can say. People have chosen for me what was my future. I was treated as a... That was my fault.
I totally understand your point here. I suppose where I'm coming from is we've all seen Newcastle and Spurs and know what a great player you were. A lot of Irish people wouldn't have heard you speak about this, and it's an amazing story. It's awful for you,
I
understand.
It's not an amazing story. It's my story.
Yeah. Do you mind if we talk about it for 2 or 3 minutes?
We already... Talk about.
Well, I suppose the.
No,
I know, but well, it's the fallout, really, which is.
It's not the fallout. It's just the fact that when you have a manager who doesn't take his responsibility in a defeat, and put all the blame on you, this is something to avoid.
We're talking about Gerard Houllier.
This is something I will not do as a manager in the future.
And his line was that Ginola has fired a missile through French football.
Yeah.
For one pass.
Yes.
And the question I was going to ask was, as you drove away from the ground that night, did you think to yourself, what has happened tonight is going to have a big impact on my career?
No. No, because I was still playing great football with my club. But it was an impact because it was a lot of sponsors and they were already in America with the French team. So when we didn't make it, I mean, it was just... such a disappointment for everyone, even more than that. I mean, I don't know, they wanted probably to make an example. It's a very strange feeling, because after that it wasn't the same anymore. Even if I end up the season with Paris and we won the league and I won Players' Player of the Year, I could feel that, you know, it was difficult time towards my career, so I had to make some choices.
From French fans in the stadiums, do you mean?
Yeah, because when you have a manager saying that if we are not going to America, this is his fault. People are understanding something, and everywhere when you're traveling with your team, you have in front of you French fans. It doesn't matter if you play in Toulouse or in Metz or in Brest or in Lyon. They are French fans when they're watching the national team. So you're going to play in those cities with Paris. And you represent Paris, but you are also the national player.
Yeah. A last question on this, and you've been very generous and I appreciate it. When you're watching World Cup 98 and you work with the BBC at the final, the following year, playing for Spurs... you win Players' Player of the Year. I can only imagine how difficult that is to watch the World Cup final.
You say it all.
Can you remember that night for us?
Oh, yes. I think I will remember that all my life, because because he's like stealing a dream from a kid.
Yeah.
Well, they stole my dream, and that's it. Simple as that. I was there, was watching, and I say, oh my God, this is very difficult to cope. And I wasn't really sure if I wanted to cover the World Cup with BBC. Any broadcaster, because, yes. No, not BBC, any broadcaster, just being there. Yeah. Because when they won, I was probably the only French person with my family being sad. I was really down, very mellow, very concerned about what's going on.
Yeah.
Because it was a great moment for France. It was a great moment for French football. And I thought at the time that I was representing well my country abroad, mm-hmm. and I deserved something really better.
You talked about the hotel that night, and the Champs-Élysées invaded, and there's parties, and
yeah.
You're on your phone to friends, or you're with your family, or and you were even wishing that you could have done it for your father, you know, that he would have seen this great moment. And do you think about that much now? I know it's people like me come along and say, David, can we talk about this? But when I'm not annoying you with questions about it.
Every day.
Really? Every day?
Every day. Every day. Every day. There's not a day that I'm not for a long time, but for 1 minute thinking about would have been fantastic to live this sort of moments in your career. This is when I say every day, I'm not lying. I'm just saying that it's something you want. It's probably the thing I regret the most in football.
But we saw this on balls.ie, Niall Quinn talking about his Charlie Haughey moment.
Oh, great.
Yeah. Do you want accents in this story or not? I mean, I can't promise good accents.
Oh, it's up to you, okay. Joe. I think it's your call on whether you're good enough to do them.
Okay, I'm probably not, but here we go. So he's talking about a Charlie Haughey speech to the team at juncture. I'm not quite sure when. Those of us brought up in Ireland stood there in amazement, and he made a speech about the sporting sons of Ireland. It was hair standing on the back of the neck stuff. Tony Cascarino was behind me and said loudly, "Who the F is that?" Ruining the moment. That's not the best bit.
Oh, no.
I thought, oh my God. And I said, that's the Taoiseach. Andy Townsend was beside him, and he said really loudly again, "Who is that, Cass?" Accents were a bad choice.
No, that was good.
All right, okay.
It's definitely the story I'm laughing at.
"Who is that, Cass?" And Cass turns to him and said, "I don't know. Quinny says he owns a tea shop."
Oh, no. I hear.
That's true. It's a true story.
Okay.
Niall Quinn doesn't lie. One of the extraordinary things about that period where you score that goal against Brazil and you're a young man and you're thrust into the spotlight like this is there was a horrible backdrop going on the whole time. And even on the flight home, you were being racially abused.
On the flight out there. Never mind the flight home. On the flight out there, they had two members of the National Front who had the banners. This was an acceptable part of life generally, not just football, because you had it in the streets. You had discrimination in the streets. So that was the way it was back then. Obviously, the overt racism in terms of incidents like that don't happen anymore. But that's not to say it doesn't exist, because we can still see parts going. So, but we've come a long way, but we've still got a long way to go.
Yeah. Like, there's horrible footage of those National Front like, they're being filmed talking to reporters saying, "Well, I know it was 2-0, but John scored one of them, so it was only 1-0 in our
eyes." But I crossed the ball for Mark Hatley, so it was nil all then, really, because if I didn't cross, he wouldn't score. But as I said, listen, it didn't affect me at all.
Well, that
did not affect me at all.
Well, I wanted to get onto that and ask you about that, because even you fast forward a couple of years and Liverpool come calling, and you get letters. Liverpool had one black player at that stage in their history.
Yeah.
For people in my generation, it's hard to even believe that so recently was the situation. And you're getting letters from fans saying, "Don't join the club." And you're a young guy, still relatively young, having to deal with all this. And I just am surprised that you've always said it never bothered me.
But even as a 17-year-old, don't forget, I came from Jamaica when I was 13. And I came from a middle-class Jamaican family. My father was a diplomat. So I felt that I was a fully empowered human being. So now I've come into England and people want to abuse me and disenfranchise me by racially abusing me. It doesn't make sense, because I feel I'm a a complete human being. So how can that upset me? How can it upset me because people are going to throw bananas or make monkey chants? Because I'm not a monkey. I do like bananas. So, you know. And of course, I was happy to see Dani Alves eat the banana the other day. So when a lot of players say that they had to bite their lip so that it didn't upset them, I never had to do that because it never, when they were trying to, regardless of the abuse that they're giving you or the type of abuse they're giving you, what they're trying to do is they're trying to say that they're better than you. And I knew they weren't. I didn't feel I was better than them, but I didn't feel, you know, inferior in any way, shape or form. So, and I also understood from a very early age, and it is still true now, about racism in sport, if you like, rather than racism in life. The racism that exists in life is much more impactful than in sport. Because in sport, in many respects, it's unreal. Because whoever racially abused me when I played for Watford against West Ham, for example, if I played for West Ham and I scored a hat-trick, they'll cheer me. And, you know, so I got racially abused by Liverpool fans when I played for Watford. Then I went to Liverpool, the Evertonians racially abused me. If I played for Everton and I scored a hat-trick, maybe the Liverpool, we don't know.
Yeah.
So in sport, if you score goals, we always look for something to get at the opposition. Whereas what's much more important is in everyday life when we see inner cities and we see the social climate in terms of education and housing and what's going on for, if you just want to talk about black and white in inner cities with young black kids not being able to get a good education and good housing. Mm. And I think a lot of people are absolving themselves of responsibility by saying society is fine, it's just football's problem.
Yeah.
And that for me is the biggest crime. And that is why also I would warn footballers now, I would warn black footballers now not to talk about how we can't be managers or I'm being racially abused in Ukraine. I'm on 300 grand a week and I go to Ukraine once a year and they racially abuse me, so what? You know what I mean? But we're on the front page saying that. Why not talk about the real issues, either if you talk about Yaya Touré in his country or what's going on in the world, rather than talking about how terrible it is. I'm driving my Bentley and I've been racially abused in Ukraine. Come on.
Because I was going to ask how quickly that vociferous overt racism, like there's the picture from your first season at Liverpool, the infamous, awful picture where you play Everton, it's going to go up on the screen. Everybody knows the photo at home that we're talking about, the banana thrown in the field.
I don't even remember doing that.
Do you
seriously,
not?
I don't remember doing it at all. But, you know, because this was a high-profile game, Liverpool versus Everton. So, of course, a lot's made of it. It's an iconic picture and people remember it.
Yeah.
This is in 1988, maybe?
1988, yeah.
From 1982, when I played for Watford at Millwall and West Ham, bananas were coming on the field all the time. But because it wasn't a high-profile situation, nothing was reported of it. So this was a common occurrence for all. So as much as, yes, Liverpool-Everton, two of the best teams, iconic picture.
Yeah.
For me, this is just a natural occurrence for the last 6 years of me playing football anyway.
Because I do remember, when I was reading during the week, the Everton chairman came out in a big way at the time and said, this is disgraceful. And your response was, and that's why I started off with the Maracanã and the flight, was this has been happening to me for years.
Well, exactly. So what I'm saying is that now because it's high-profile and people are now appalled by it, but that was happening not just at Liverpool versus Everton, all wherever black players played, that happened. So maybe the good thing that it really brought it to people's attention, possibly, but you know, this has been going on for such a long time and it really took an incident like this for it to change, which is a bit sad, but at least, you know, something was done.
You know the way you say you were an empowered person? I presume that was to do with your upbringing. You didn't feel like a disenfranchised black man. You felt like I'm a person, I'm a whole person.
Absolutely.
Were there other players in the game who struggled with it, who maybe came to you and said, I don't know, do I get into a fight with them? Well, do I ignore it?
Well, a lot of them did. A lot of them did. And of course, I remember when I first came to England, a lot of my friends playing in London, these young black kids who didn't make it, who I assumed were equally as good as me, some of them even better than me, but... And even when I first started playing professionally, a lot of black players back then in the early 80s were lost to the game because they would fight against it, they'd put up. And what we were told for players who didn't like it is you have to put up with it. Put up with it, bite your tongue, you know, or else you have a chip on your shoulder if you want to fight and you want to complain. So just get on with it, it builds character. I didn't have to put up with it because it didn't really affect me. But for a lot of players who it affected them and it drove them out of the game because they couldn't cope with it.
Yeah.
Now, you have to look at the way they've been brought up in a situation. If they're from an inner city in London where they see their parents not being able to get jobs, they've been brought up in this environment whereby they are being disenfranchised daily, nothing to do with football. Then they get into football and it continues to happen. So I completely empathize and understand. And I always use Ian Wright as an example. You know, I always talk about me being Martin Luther King, get it right, and Ian is Malcolm X. You know, both want the same things but in different ways. So Ian would fight against it because of his existence, the way he's been brought up.
Sorry to interrupt. Do you think that's the wrong approach or is there a right approach?
Well, you have to be true to who you are.
Okay.
So there's no wrong or right. I would always hope that people will be confident in themselves as human beings not to let it get to them.
Yeah.
But I can't say to someone, if that is not their nature, oh, don't let it get to you. You know, you're a fully empowered human being. You know, there's idiots, blah, blah, blah. Don't let it get to you. That's why when people say, what advice would you give to people? You have to be true to who you are. And if what Ian Wright needed to do to become the player he was to kick and fight and scream.
To get angry.
And that's what he did.
What
does the World Cup mean to these kids?
Well, the only player they talk about is Neymar, if I'm honest. But for the World Cup, it's massive for them because they're children, but they don't realise that all the money that it's taking away from the national budget. But none of these kids will ever get to the Maracanã. None of these kids will ever go to see Christ the Redemptor because it costs 70 AIs. None of these kids will ever go to see Sugarloaf.
Really?
No, no, none of them. You can ask Carlo if he's ever been to them. I doubt it severely.
Ask him there.
Carlo, was er vi Pão de Açúcar?
No.
Okay.
Carlo B?
Carlo, quantos anos você?
37.
Wow. Never been to Sugarloaf. Normal para pessoa de favela via Pão de Açúcar? No, it's not normal for people in the favela to go there because it costs money. They can't go there. So they can't go to the Maracanã. Now it's been done up. It costs a lot more money than it used before.
This is true. I mean, we should mention this, that since it's been done up, the price has not doubled or trebled. It's gone up tenfold. So essentially, the average person here has been completely priced out of going ever back to the Maracanã for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, so not only has the World Cup sucked all of the resources that should have gone in hospitals and so on and so forth, yeah. And let me stress, I love football, but Carlo and his friends can't go to watch a local game in the Maracanã now because the cheapest seats are now 100 AIs, which is about 35, 40 euros, yeah. Which would be maybe a week's wages for them. So they can't afford to go to the Maracanã anymore. Yeah. They'll just watch it on television.
But the protests last year, you know, we saw them in the Confederations Cup and it was this widespread movement. People might be under the misconception that that was led from the favelas, that that was a politically minded, angry underclass here. Whereas in actual fact, it was kind of left-wing academics, it was trade unions, workers. You made the point as we went on that cable car journey over the favelas, which went on forever. Do you think these people could even afford to get down to protest?
They couldn't even afford to get down to protest. They couldn't be bothered because they don't think their voice would be heard. But just purely from a monetary perspective, they're not going to pay to get the bus to go in to protest. They can't afford that. So yeah. They're not marching the streets. They're the ones that they're marching on the streets for. But if people say, oh, how come there's not like a million people marching the streets? Well, it's because these million of people need to eat. And that's more important than going to a protest for them.
I asked you earlier if they're angry and you said it's more resignation.
Yeah, I mean, even looking at Carlo there when he was talking, he wasn't angry or raising his voice. He's just resigned to the fact that the Olympic Village and all that is going to be done in Zona Sul, even though the Olympic Stadium is in Zona North. They're going to regenerate an area that's already wealthier than many parts of Dublin, yeah. And they're going to leave the areas around the stadium which need the regeneration just rot, basically.
Well, I think of you, and I think of you talking about a pretty bird on the tree at Augusta rather than telling me where Fred Couples is on the money list.
It's nice to know where Fred is, but it only interests Fred Couples and the bank manager, really. Nobody else gives a stuff.
Can I play you a clip, actually? Because we were looking on YouTube today, just looking at some of your commentary, and see, again, this is a perfect example of what you say is just bloody easy and what we kind of think is genius. So this is 2010, and as is usual, Freddie Couples is having a great first round at the Masters, and this is your thoughts as he hits his final shot into 18.
Oh, Freddie, you really are adorable. What a gentleman. Look at those old winkle pickers. You can just see him in front of the fire with a pipe. Oh, you're not allowed to do that now. He'll be in bed in an hour and a half's time with a bowl of gruel, electric blanket on low.
Who are you broadcasting to there, Peter? Who do you have in mind?
My Auntie Nellie. I also said once, I have these peculiar whims. I collect walks, and so the best walker, of course, in the world ever was Sean Connery. And they were talking about Fred Couples, and Fred was on, and we were talking about Ken Brown, or Alex Hay, bless him, might have said, do you think people grow to look like their pets? You know, pretty women looking like an Afghan hound, you know, with hair, blonde hair, you know. I said, well, yes. I said, take Fred Couples, for example. In another world, Fred Couples could only have been a black Labrador. Hmm. He could only have been a black Labrador. You look at Fred and the easygoing way it is, and gentle and just plods along. He was a black Labrador in another world, Fred Couples. He was never a Pekingese or an Alsatian. He was a black Labrador. Very simple.
I've no idea what you're talking about, and yet it makes perfect sense.
Well, we're coming to an end of it, I'm afraid. The BBC have been outgunned by Sky, and we've got another couple of years to go. I don't know. I haven't made up my mind yet. I might finish at St Andrews this year.
Oh, really?
Well, I might do. I don't know.
News Talk 106 to 108.